understand that the speech or art process is becoming quite emotional at certain points. Saying one another by sending happy notes. I'm glad we haven't sunk that goal yet. And if possible, let's try to achieve this. Completely reason why we should. Alright, Digi, you and your team, welcome and congratulations again. And let's begin where we left off yesterday.
Thank you very much, and good morning, honorable members and colleagues. Today we are starting off on the involved government. The integrated response to areas that we wanted to be identified to improve the turnaround time in the work that we do as the support staff in the office. We started doing this work about in 2011 to start checking, and the reason why we started checking it was that we were approached by the judge president of the North Gauteng High Court, and the system was in dire straits at that time. So we thought we would check the system and we will ensure that the work is now on its head, and we will start the process. And that's how we became in love with this work. Basically, generally, the default judgments happen after the summons are lodged and there is no defense by the defendant in the matter. And generally, it happens in civil matters where there is a claim pretty much sounding in money. So during the period under review, maybe before the period under review, during that period when the complaint was presented before us, what we did was we had to send people, we had to employ contract workers to go and assist their court, but also go and assist the South Gauteng High Court, which was experiencing similar problems, maybe not to the same extent. We identified two areas. It was default judgment and it was succession. Now, in both areas, we have since improved and managed to do a somewhat complete turnaround from where we were then to where we are today, both in terms of human capacity that is doing work, as well as in terms of output, in terms of delivery. What we are concentrating on as well is just to focus on mitigating any risk that could be associated with lack of training and or sometimes untoward doing. During the period under review, therefore, we had 316,000 default judgment applications, which we concluded by the clerk of court. And the previous year, we had a number much less than that, but we had achieved slightly better results than the current year. That was not reflected in the slide. So once we had targeted, and in fact, this was the first year that we set our target in specific terms. So once, because the previous year we were doing the baseline study of how long it takes us to do default judgments and all of that. So we then created this key performance indicator, percentage of default judgment performed by clerks of court and granted within 14 days, and we said the target was going to be 65%, and we ultimately achieved 56%. The reason why we are excited, even though it's not an achievement of a full target as yet, it's because it was the first year that we had a baseline, and we are now working and trying to change a baseline. But what we believe, and that's why we are excited, is what we believe this is beginning to do, is that it's beginning to bring justice to those people who otherwise would have had to wait forever because there are delays in those processes. And now that we are tracking, and we now know that it's doable within 14 days, we now know that if the defendant has not responded to a certain period of time and you apply for a default judgment, you are going to have it within a period of time. Then specify that it should be settled and there is no. Similarly, with taxation, the storyline is the same, and we had a target of 65% to achieve taxation within 14 days, and we were able to surpass the target by just a few odd percentages, and we think we can sustain the target going forward. The capacitation of the Chief Justice
on the matter of the court charge, have you considered the reason why you did not oppose this application? Because I imagine sometimes it will be called of the game of a student, or sometimes it should just be a question of the person not in a way. And also, the number of application for the decision of the judgment, and also the number of those that you can get, whether so that in terms of where you, I see you concentrate more on the fact that the whole judgment that are achieved can get, and yet they are only going to be people who also. Now it would be good to know as to how many of that whole judgment are coming from.
Indeed, we are looking at that, and in terms of default judgments, we did look and we continue to look at why are people not responding to some of them that are being set. And there are one or two reasons which we have picked up, which we are discussing with the board of sheriffs, I think. And those are issues that we want to raise with them even when we speak, because we do feel that sometimes the service of someone sometimes is not as high as it ought to be. But as you know, the Honourable House would know that in the recent past it approved the sheriff legislation. There is a broader transformation that is currently obtaining in that environment. Oh, thank you. I thought I switched it off. Just sorry about that. One of the areas of transformation is capacitating and educating the public on the rules of service, and so that people are served correctly with court process, whether it's summons or any other court process for that matter, because we do realize that there are people that indeed are prejudiced by the fact that the service has not been proper. But having said that, it's not in most of these default judgments that you would find, and I'm saying anecdotally because we haven't done a thorough analysis which is scientific, so anecdotally it's not most of the default judgments that are granted that way that the defendant did not know. It is that the defendant knew but was not able to do anything about it, because if they did something about it at that point in time, the default judgment would not have been granted or did not seek to defend the matter. And that then present most America to a different space everywhere. So that is the one area that we pick up and that we are involving in the manner that I've already suggested. Secondly, we discovered that the defendants sometimes tend just they tend to move a lot, and so they are not kind of found where they are, whether they are at work or elsewhere, they are not found in their place where they are normally ordinarily resident. And because they're not found, then they're served through the normal rule. But if someone goes and attends someone in my house and I've moved, it then becomes difficult for a person to find them. And that's where we find rescission applications have been the greatest, where service was in the form of attending the summons at the door, rather than where the summons are served on the person and the person did nothing. So those are the two areas that we've picked up. It doesn't mean those are the only areas that we've picked up, and it's an area that we're going to be looking at to try and see how do we then create indicators for ourselves to be able to track that and monitor it and develop trends around this area. Thank you, Chair.
End of those that are actually resilient. Are you able to give an indication that many of them
heard for you, the rescission application are many, and just and again it's anecdotal because we haven't done scientific study necessarily, but in just talking to the class of court and going through the register where they register their activities, the rescission remain many, and in part one of the reasons, again anecdotally, that makes them many is that in any event where you have already settled the plaintiff, where you've already settled the plaintiff with the consent of the plaintiff, you can then apply for rescission, but with consent. So what we have not been doing is we have not been distinguishing where there has been poor service and where it's a rescission, because you've honored, as the defendant, you've honored your obligations to the plaintiff, and it is now with consent that you are applying for rescission. What just arising from the question, what I think we need to do is to then make that distinction when you have the rescission applications that are occasioned by whatever other reason other than the consent of the plaintiff, and where you have rescissions that are occasioned by the fact that the defendant has honored all his or her obligations to the plaintiff. And maybe that's something that we can think about, and when we come back in the future, we can report on it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. I think, you know, this is an area that sometimes may have to be given much closer monitoring. Remember, we are about access to justice. But the same justice system sometimes abuses. And it may be abused because of the fact that the public does not know the law. And to some extent, maybe what you need to also consider regarding the case is you need to actually maybe get how you provide the statistics. Whether or not you have a problem, that is actually managed to inform the public. Like, for example, if you look at what the National Gambling Board does, they have the pathological gambler, what do you call that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But they have a program. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that actually tells where to stop, you know, and it's good because they are about gambling. Mm-hmm. But at the same time they are irresponsible in the sense that if what is their business create a problem, the problem comes here. And even in this case, I think the Department of Justice needs to actually make this their problem. When the same justice system is actually abused, and you find that instead of the public benefiting from it, the public is actually being abused for other establishments to make money out of it. But if they can't find somebody to the someone, what do they do now with the order? They find the person when they got the order, but they couldn't find them when they wanted to come in. So those are some of the things that we could look at and maybe have programs around.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the question. Then we look at the capacitation of the Office of the Chief Justice. Honourable members will recall that this project started in 2010, kind of at conceptual phase, but we actually seconded people in 2010 for them to go and do some work and to prepare for the presentation of the Office of the Chief Justice. We had entered into a service level agreement with the Office of the Chief Justice to be able to start doing some work, and we have progressed quite significantly in some areas, but there are those areas that remain behind schedule. Now, in areas where we've progressed, we've managed to, for instance, get the Secretary General equivalent to the DG appointed to head that office, so the head of administration is already in place. We've put in systems in that office, controls and all of those issues we've addressed. to a point where we were able to address. Some will only be addressed when certain actions have come through from your national treasury or wherever it has to come through in terms of the responsible authority. We've prepared as much as possible for that office to be granted its own vote so that its own accounting officer then becomes an accounting officer in law and in fact. We in addition to that, we've had several conversations around the appointment of their own audit committee, their own internal audit when the time is right, their own infrastructure, insofar as the ICT and all of those issues. So those discussions are very advanced. And in some areas, there are activities on the ground, so there is a lot that's going on there. But insofar as the appointment of capacitating the position, the human capacity side of things, during the year under review, 41% of the 148 funded positions were filled against the target of 50%. So basically, there are already people here who I think is already there. There are some people in IT services, as I've said, the head of the office is already in place. The capacity that we are now working to try and analyze the capacity to work on the systems, and let me give an example of what I mean. So capacity to work on the systems refer to people who are going to operate CASAL. One, the office of the chief justice will come and vote, has a vote of its own, because then it will have its own CASAL system, it will have its own procurement system, which will be vast, and so on and so on. So now it's that capacity that we are just been finalizing, and we believe that within the course of this month we should be able to get those processes approved by the chief justice as well as our minister respectively. At which point then it's probably going to be consistent. So we believe that the transfer of the function, we are not going to just wake up and transfer everything to the office of the chief justice. We've identified the areas that we think would be transferred in the beginning, and those are the areas that are going through an approval process, so I'm not able to talk publicly about them. But we also believe that it will be a progressive transfer so that we do not transfer in those areas where we may not have still sufficient capacity at that point. Just for the benefit of the honourable members, how this project has worked is that there are certain officials in the Department of in the Department of Justice who are also going to be transferred to the Office of the Chief Justice so that they continue to do the work that they have already been doing. And we do not believe that there will be any prejudice on the part of those employees because they will be transferring almost on the same level that they would have been in the Department of Justice. And that's the process that will unfold. Progressively, Chair, I think in NS it will start on the 1st of April 2018. That's because the vote, if it is granted, it will be installed by that period, in the beginning of the financial year. Even though progressively, between now and October, between October and February, a lot will have happened between ourselves, the Office of the Chief Justice, and National Treasury, as well as the PSA, to lock up all of those arrangements, including public work in terms of the infrastructure. Thank you. Now, the South African Judicial Education Institute has been one of those areas that was litigated quite a while back, but in terms of take-off, it really struggled to take off. But it has taken off in the recent past. We got a process going as well there, and the chief executive officer was appointed. Honourable members would recall that this has been an area where the director would have had to be a judge, a retired judge. And so we had a retired judge for a little while, but that arrangement didn't work as well as it was anticipated. It soon became clear that in terms of the current legislation, the Sanji Act, those functions are very administrative. And whilst the training may be specialized to be done by judge or judges, but the overall coordination of that is very administrative, and it was felt that maybe an administrator, someone with administrative capabilities, would be best suited to run the administration part of the institute. So that process has started, and they've already started doing the training. And they had done work in collaboration with Justin College, but this year, the year that we are in now, we have not had an arrangement for work to be done by Justice College for their training. So we believe now the magistrates in particular are going to benefit from being trained by SAGE rather than being trained by AFAD. And we've given an indication of the type of training that is somewhat lagging behind, because, for example, your PAJA is by year training and all of those things, which we were under pressure to bring the magistrates to the level required for them to be designated. So that training, we believe they will then prioritize in the institute.
The role and status of Justice College?
The role and status of Justice College, Chair, if I may respond this way. Justice College has been training the judiciary as well as people in the prosecution, legal aid, ourselves, and to a certain extent even people from other departments, but has also had an international component of training for and on behalf of the country in terms of the country agreement that we enter into with, in particular the SADC country. So it has, all along it has been doing that. So the only component that has gone out of Justice College is the judiciary. The prosecution remains, the government remains, and the international component remains. But what we also thought we would do with the Justice College is that perhaps Honorable Member Jage talked a lot about training. We had said we would use Justice College not only to train necessarily, but to do two additional things, and of course fund things. We thought we were going to start with the program this year, but we have not been able to start with the program this year because the funds just do not permit us to. We thought it would become, call it a center of conversation, where if we have a program, if we have a bill, we can generate opinions and conversations and analysis and research, not research in the sense of the law reform commission, but on the issue at hand, and try and ensure that it reaches that level of being a center of excellence for Justice College. That is the one element that we have thought it would do. Secondly, we thought it would start producing written material of journals around our own experiences as a department and how the development in the democratic South Africa, the journey it has traveled, and all those things in terms of just creating, call it a repository of knowledge for people who will then come and work for the department going forward. Those two projects are projects that we are trying to plan for, because obviously financially we have not been able to start them current financial year for the reasons to this honorable house. But given all the challenges that we had suffered as a department, I recall I presented here in the house about a year and a half, if not 2 ago, and I said we thought we would change our training matrix. Instead of all officials of the Department of Justice training everywhere, we will consolidate the training, we will prioritize the training so that you have internal training that improves administration of the department. And Justice College, we've worked very well with them to get us to this point where they train on default judgment, on taxation, on those things that they were not training as much on, even though they continue to train on our core business and justice, which is training on sexual offences and the rest of those things. So we've kind of given them two approaches, as it were, the internal approach that helps us improve our governance, and the core business approach where we improve the access to justice type of approach. And in the year that has been the reporting year, they also started training in ICT in the department, just to bring everybody to speak, because if we are going to move the department into using more ICT in our business, it means that we must have people that are capable of doing so, and that is what Justice Focus is going to be. So it's not going to be any less. In fact, we've given them much more work than they used to have with training motivation. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. This 350 judicial officers trained by the ADPI, how many do you pay a magistrate and how many are
trained?
1,900. I'm looking at the checking for the achievement. Sorry. In that achievement, how many are magistrates and how many judges? And secondly, what are they being said on when you mention Paya and Paya? I think one example, but would they also be trained on automatic law, for instance? Because the term of the case would be developed in what to do with customer law. It ties up with my request yesterday to Charles. I think it was a device to get clarified that the other judicial officers have been trained on. But I'm sure the other judicial officers are not included in that major.
Thank you very much, Chair. We will provide a breakdown of the 350 that are trained. But, sorry, no, the 1,956 that are trained. But maybe let me speak to what are they trained on. The examples I given were given because that was a priority training that Parliament had asked us last time when we were here. They are trained particularly on the social context training. Social context training in the context of the, right now we are going through the appointment, the recruitment in the we are going through the recruitment process by the Chief Justice in the PSC, I couldn't remember, the Commission. But, and so you would then, through that process, have new judges who are appointed. Before they start work, they do go through some form of training. Before the magistrates, when they are recruited, before they start doing work, they get introduced to the context of being a judicial officer and therefore the conduct issues and all of that. But the work itself, if you are a presiding officer, what is expected of you, how you preside over cases, how you plan and all of that. So that is the one content training that they generally go through. The other, obviously, right now I'm going to come back to the chair if I'm allowed, just to indicate the purpose of developing the curriculum. I'll come back to that. But I'm just telling what was the training structure for the incoming judicial officer. So that's generally, now those who would have been doing more criminal work then are introduced to more civil work and vice versa in terms of the training. So that is the one aspect. Then from time to time, as Parliament approves legislation and that legislation goes into an implementation phase, they are trained on their legislation. So it would have been child justice in the past 3 years, it would have been sexual offences, acts, and so on and so on. Naturally, the Chief Justice is the key driver of case law management. So on case law management, obviously, I take it will also form part of the curriculum, the new curriculum that is going to be developed and approved by the committee that said is responsible for approving the curriculum in the structure of the of study. So those type of training. Now, in terms of customary law, I can't say sitting here specifically, and it would be something that I would have to go back and check whether that is calling how far and how much did it do when it was responsible for training. I also cannot say sitting here that the new curriculum will have customary law, but I can understand why it wouldn't have customary law. As long as I'm not understood to say it won't. There's no reason why it shouldn't, if customary law, as I know it to be, is applied in our legal system. So they will have to train on it. What we will do, just to come back and answer that question specifically, is we will get the information from the Chief Executive and ensure that we respond formally to the honorable member through the chair.
Thank you. In essence, for the judicial officers, one who is training, a new appointment. extend the comrades, you know, and then with that, that would consider themselves in relationship to the work. And then who would, in what extent would they cooperate with that kind of program?
So remember, the most amazing thing is that obviously, well, based on availability, if judge has booked him or herself to be on training, they have been attending training. We have not had major difficulties. We experienced the same difficulties that we experienced with the department where sometimes someone has something very urgent and they can't pull out of, but otherwise they do attend training. Perhaps if I were to take that question further and say what is the uptake of the training that is offered by the institute, and I'm not going to speak to institutes because really my experience would be limited so much to the Justice College. So I will talk about history rather than what the institute does today. My experience is that they have been making themselves available, but if you were to compare the domestic training as opposed to international training, maybe that's the comparison we need to do going forward, just to check whether the international training is more attractive to domestic training. And I'm using this because it's the same analysis that we want to also do for ourselves, to say, is training offered in-house less attractive to training that is offered externally? And if that is the case, why? So that we can work on that. We are not saying people should never be trained externally, but we are saying because of the cost, and if you want to optimize both the number of people who you are training and the cost which you are expending in training those people, it would make sense to train most people domestically. What we had made certain recommendations to the Office of the Chief Justice that in some areas it would assist if an international trainer of note comes to South Africa and trains the majority of the judiciary rather than each traveling individually to train abroad. But that's a call that the Office of the Chief Justice going forward will have to make in managing that and in answering that question going forward. But they do attend the training.
The just to get back to the question raised, the training though, it is with Sajid. We work very closely with him in terms of influencing some of the issues that were picking up where they are problems, where we suggest that, can they look into the, for example, on maintenance. I think the question that was raised yesterday on quantum, where we feel that maybe, sometimes the courts need to take more of a look on the side of the criminal functions, and we believe that it should be taking more interest in civil remedies because you won't get money. So we would collaborate with such especially vulnerable groups. Sometimes we even find some of the things that say, look, there's a guy I meet in this area for training, so we then collaborate with Sajid in terms of, sourcing whoever would then be driving the training. So it's not like, we don't have a role. We closely collaborate so that the things that are of patent interest, especially to members of the public, so that it's not just focused on theoretical, judicial training. We also want to get training focusing on practical issues that members of the public are, finding problems with, so that the judiciary are aware of this and then, we can then attend to it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. I was looking for Onika and my apologies. We have a slight problem, and I should have apologized this morning. Onika is responsible for the state attorney, but we had an urgent case that she's busy trying to put the minister in the JSC right now, so I apologize for that. But I think Kalei will assist us in responding to the issues relating to Program 3 when they pertain to the state attorney. Thank you. Then on Program 3 is purpose is to provide the assistance to government primarily,
to supervise the administration of the estate, the insolvent estate, and the guardian fund to prepare and promote legislation and undertake research in support of legislative development. It has the following strategic objectives: increase efficiency in the provision of services to beneficiaries and of the guardian fund services, to service trust insolvent estates as well as constitutional advocacy and participating democracy, to strengthen and ensure respect of fundamental human rights, to improve provision of legal services to state organs, and the legislative development for effective and efficient justice services. Now, if I start with the master's environment, I have already indicated that we opened a brand new office. It's leaked, I mean, it's not evident. It will be attached to the master of the High Court once the High Court is in place, because this is the master of the High Court, and the services must be offered as close as possible to that environment. But I just wanted to clarify that when we say we open a service point, it doesn't mean we now own that space. This service point was opened last year, and this is one of the areas where we decided we were never going to have files to begin with, physical files, that is, and every file is registered on the system, so we operate on a paperless system. We've already registered 1,381 estates from June 2012 to March 2018, so it does have a good uptake. It's not situated in a very accessible area, Chair. We really struggled to find space in the city of Malang to be able to have to run the office there. But despite that, it has had very good uptake from all types of communities that are there. So we think it's inconvenient, but we think it's still accessible. In protecting the interests of minors, the master countrywide referred 1,887 matters to Legal Aid South Africa to assist. This escalated to 2,071 matters in 2012, which when we started this program. Now, honorable members would know that prior to 2011-2012 financial year, Legal Aid was not doing this work. We approached them because we had realized that in terms of the small estates, where primarily they are child-headed estates, we found that they were not benefiting as much as they ought to benefit from their own estate because of the legal group associated with them. We then put in Legal Aid, and we are grateful to them because they agreed to come to the party. We entered into a protocol arrangement with them, and they have been assisting us, and you can see that the numbers speak for themselves in terms of the assistance that those otherwise estates that would have had to be dealt with by the legal profession. We provided information on the internet on several areas of our activities, in particular the forms that must be used, and this is where people are using the electronic system. We do provide similar information in different ways to people who still go to master's offices and do physical applications as it were. During the financial year under review, 209,000 people accessed our website, and 21,748 accessed the portal in total 633 pages of the information that is on the website was existing at any given point in time. Now, the key area of focus that we focused on was just building the system in terms of the masters, so that at least the system could withstand the pressure of the traffic we think is going to be generated by using the paperless system. With regard to the improving the turnaround times in the services that are offered by the master, generally we had a mixed bag of performance, but overall our performance was still in the region of about just below the budget, but above 80% generally. So the person, the performance is set up. The letters issued, and we exceeded the target, and we're excited about that because it's an area that we have been checking quite strongly. We wanted that was begun on time, because it takes forever to mine, and our priority is to try and ensure that they are wound within reasonable time and they are mitigated within reasonable time, and people are able to access money arising out of this space. Litigation with low target, we missed the target by 5%. Beneficiaries that are paid by the Guardian Fund within 40 days, we missed the target as well, but again, we were very close to the target in those areas. I'd like just to speak to one area, which is the certificates of appointment issued in all bankruptcies. Those certificates have to be issued within 10 days. Honourable Member will realise that we missed the target by March, and the reason why I'm explaining it is because of the general capacity constraints in the master's environment. What we have done was we have said we will try and reprioritise capacity as and when we need to try and deal with those high pressure points. We are not saying that there is pressure points, but at least we felt that if we prioritize the guardian fund, if we prioritize the litigation, if we prioritize all these other areas, we can see big attractions and create capacity for things to work themselves in those areas and then come back and improve on this. So it's not as if we are neglecting it, but we just have to make do with what we have. We recently appointed in this area the chief director who is responsible, amongst others, for the human rights aspect, and because it was just not capacity. That is one of the positions of DDG that we have not been able to appoint has been in this area. We tried a few times and really we have struggled, but we hope to get that one right eventually. Now, this is the new program, the standalone program, given the fact that it was established as a branch in late 2010, and so it's a new program in that way. But the work has been ongoing prior to the establishment of the branch as it were. So we, under this branch, we have constitutional advocacy program. It's a three-year program funded by the European Union, and it's a grassroots program, and it empowers civil organizations that support projects, in particular that deals with the rights of vulnerabilities. 91% of the planned targets were achieved in 2012-2013 financial year, and in addition, we were assisted by the foundation quite significantly in prioritizing other areas that were not part of the program, but were very urgent for that work be done in those areas. The numbers, the honorable members, speak for themselves, and I don't think there's anything in addition that we need to explain. I just appreciate the partnership with the European Union and the Foundation for Human Rights because they have enabled us to have the reach and somewhat of a footprint even in areas where we would otherwise not have that much of a footprint. Last year, the minister visited one of the courts in the East Rand, and announced and gave acknowledgement to a number of organizations that have been set up by the Foundation for Human Rights that are doing justice work in that area. And we believe that they are doing a lot more work than they are credited for in our presentation. And it's an area that we would like at some point to brief the portfolio committee on at a different point in time. Sure. We then move to PAJA implementation.
Yes, I think we related the question. Yes, I think. There was an organization that gives advice to communities in our own area, this legal advice center. And they were telling me that they are getting a lot of people who come to them ask for their advice, and they are looking in funds in the south. Now, I wanted to know where should they go, where should they collect their criminals and in order to seek the further assistance, because I believe they will fall under the spectrum of constitutional and political. This will be relevant debate afterwards. I just want to get confirmation that indeed they will fall under the kind of program.
Thank you very much, Chair. Through you, the naturally that work would fall under a constitutional advocacy program. Naturally, in terms of funding of that work, in the recent, well, in the current budget, we have not been funding as a department necessarily, but we have been funding through donor funding programs. The type of work. And what we normally do is we take the details of the organization just as a process, and we link them up with the foundation and or link them up with other donors. But what we try and do is we package the work so that it's bankable and the donors can then look at it and see if they can fund it. But right now, the biggest program that we are doing that work through is the Foundation for Human Rights, because they do have resources that are already dedicated for that purpose. But the resources, as you can see, are not unlimited. And what we have to do is, and we have a program which we work with EPSA on, and where we put our requirements, especially the requirements that we put forward as a department, is in the area of advocacy, because we want to reach as many people as we can. But we realize that as a department ourselves, including the Chatterland institutions, don't reach everybody in the country. So foundations like these and centers like those are able then to be an extension of the services that we can provide. And we put that work through G2Z, but it's a project that is a process that is managed by PFR, the PFA. And project implementation.
So how do you monitor the work that's done by foundation? Because it's funding that's based on bilateral reporting, then European Parliament, and I guess it then becomes your competency. How do you monitor the work?
Thank you, Honourable Member. There is a process. How should I put this? It's an informal process. And if I say it's an informal process, we don't have structured monitoring and processes. But we look at areas where they are operating in, and we ask them to come and present to our expo. And they do come and present to our expo. Sometimes we go and visit them and we participate in their work to try and see what is it that they do. So that's the one process that we do. The other process is that in terms of reporting, according to the funds that are spent, we have a donor funding unit in the department whose job it is to look at the funds that we've received, do the allocation process, and where the funds are not paid to us directly and are paid to organizations, track those and seek reports in terms of progress that is being achieved against the expenditure, well, in relation to the expenditure of those money. We have a donor funding unit that does that, but practically and operationally, we try and do it in the practical sense, and we ask them from time to time to just come and talk to us on the area that either we may consent with and or we may want to take advantage of. In addition, the unit, the branch constitutional development, interacts with them much more extensively on the work that they do, just to see
synergies where we believe there may be synergies, and to see also areas of difference where we want, where we don't want to duplicate on what they are doing and vice versa. So that's the interactions that we are having, and through these interactions we are then able to know whether they are achieving or not achieving, as the case may be. In fact, not so long ago they presented on a survey that we had requested for them to do. I'm trying to remember what we were surveying. We were surveying their reach and their understanding of the constitution on the ground, whether people are aware of the constitution, the content of the constitution, and how to access their rights emanating from the constitution. They did the survey for us and they presented that for some time, I think it was last year, late last year. That was the one area that in mechanism where we wanted to test whether they're understanding and whether their reach enables us to get to the ground.
Thank you. It might be a need for more staff monitoring. Would like them quickly address the problem that problem is in terms of other areas that are not covered. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just in terms of our relationship with the foundation, the areas that we are reporting on here, they're actually part of, so we've structured that the key indicators are actually falling within the constitutional development plan. And that's why we're able to report in terms of, you know, the outreach programs that they have done. At an operational level, within the branch court services, we meet with them on a regular basis. You know, like we have structured quarterly meetings where they're able to track their performance. So in other words, they're doing the work on our behalf for institutional development, and then we're able to report into the department. But there's also a board that they've set up where we participate, you know, so that there's proper governance in terms of the funding that they get.
We now move to part of implementation. I'm just going to go straight to the key activities. We've had a project going between ourselves and the government and administration in CLASA to really look at the how do we improve the working of government and how do we use the same legislation and other processes to improve the working of the government. And we identified that we're going to do a joint, as were, a project, which, of course, from our side, we'll be looking at other implementation. And so we are not just reporting to this cluster, but we are also, to this Honorable House, but we also use the same information to report to to the government and administration cluster. And we have found that for us, it's given us a window of opportunity, as it were, to understand more practically on the ground when we talk about PADA implementation, where is everybody at, as it were, in government, in terms of PADA is concerned. So during the under review, we undertook a few pilots, and those were done, four of them were done in the Western Cape, the Northern Cape, Limpopo, Mpumalanga. We did a workflow analysis of five administrative decisions identified in the pilot study. And basically those administrative decisions, we were looking at either in terms of applications that people would have made, decisions. Let me use an example, just as an example, and not what we mean. If a child is refused to attend a particular school, just as an example, we would try and go into that to say what process was followed, how was it communicated, and all of those things to be able to understand whether people understand.
understand an administrative decision versus a decision that does not fall within that category, just as an example. Now, that work has gone well. We have not concluded all the reports that are supposed to be finalized so that we are able to then tell this Honorable House whether people on the ground on a day-to-day basis understand what they need to do. But we are hoping to get those reports and then be able to report to this Honorable House as progress. We also convened a number of interdepartmental working group meetings to deal with the implementation challenges. And the reason why we did that was because we then got to understand that there are really implementation challenges of the Hatch Act on the ground. And those working groups ultimately will then produce a report to tell us what is it that they think we need to do to assist them in implementing the legislation differently. We produced information booklets as well, new information booklets, just to try and drill the point and clarify in areas where we thought that people are still missing or needing more guidance on how to implement the Act. And perhaps when it comes down next time, we'll even send an example of those booklets. They really read very well and very easy. If you are a decision maker, having to make the decision. We have achieved what we targeted in terms of this Act, but obviously, Honorable Member will know that a lot needs to be done in terms of the PADA Act. And what we are doing is we are taking it in bite-sizes just to and addressing those areas that we feel need particular attention and then moving on to the next area. Then we want to move to FAIA compliance in the department. This year, this reporting period, we did not achieve the target in terms of FAIA, and there is the reason for non-achievement of the target there are two or three reasons why we did not achieve the target. But in particular, it's the one that we set out just below the slide. The documents that we had received, which was the requesting information, it related to those issues that I raised yesterday in terms of the applications for appeals by those people who are sitting in correctional facilities. And so you can see that there is a direct translation of that problem to other areas in our department, and that's why we have had to prioritize it. But the point here is that when people apply to get their appeals done, we must have their records transcribed. And on the one level, the applications were correctly done, but we were not able to get the records transcribed in good time for them to do their appeal processes. And that is the reason why we have had issues. The delays in finalizing, obviously, when you do this type of work, you then go backwards and forwards from the supplier who must do the transcription to the tools and the department, and time in the meantime lapses because it is time-sensitive rather than that. But this year, the current year under review, we want to turn the situation around, and we want to ensure that we meet those deadlines, because in terms of the Act, we can go back and ask for an extension of the original time, so that if people do feel that we are doing the work, we don't just get down and miss the deadline as it was. Thank you. Thank you. Then we move to state litigation. As this message saying, we have an error in our slide of the word one. Which is on paragraph B, the last word that is standing along the NMWOM. My apologies. We missed it completely, and I apologize for that. During the 2013 financial year, 70% of police were allocated to the PDIs. Again, we are talking about value were given to the PDIs. This translates to 314 million that was paid to PDI. The bringing of female translated to 19 talents. Now, in yesterday's newspaper, before she raised the issue,
I'm not sure whether that is entirely inaccurate. But what I do know is that people get briefed, the strength of the brief generally goes to the level of exposure in that area. And so generally people will, and whether you are a male or a female, the extent of the brief, and not the value, the extent of the brief goes according to the experience that you have in a particular area. And there are those areas where we've had fantastic performance by female practitioners, and in fact those areas are generally not areas that are explored by many people. Similarly with their counterparts, in some areas their counterparts would have better work because they just have better experience in those areas. So there is indeed some element of accuracy in that article, and I just wanted to not shy away from that. That is occasioned by the, as I have indicated, the level of experience. Now, before the committee asks, so how do you mitigate against that? We've adopted two strategies, basically, in the government. Maybe two approaches, let me not say strategies. Two approaches. The one approach is that we've tried as much as possible to partner legal practitioners, the juniors with the seniors who are experts in those areas, for them to get experience. And to an extent that this has been possible, we do see a level of growth in those areas. I must indicate, however, that in some areas within the profession, not from clients, and sometimes honorable members get told that it is clients who want A or who want B. Sometimes within the legal profession, the seniors don't want to work with junior A, they prefer working with junior B. And it does present a problem for us as well in the government. Not that we are without blame in this situation, but we do experience a lot of that. And it's not even just limited to PDIs, it's across the board. They are just people who are known to work with certain people, and they are more comfortable in working with certain people. And it's an area we've been trying to break through in addressing, and therefore we will work towards that going forward. The outcomes of the cases that were concluded, it's always unfortunate that sometimes we look at success rate and failure rate immediately after we say how much work have we allocated. But the finalized cases, we finalized 570 cases of the 1,807 cases that were allocated. And obviously those were then successfully concluded. And we will talk about what that successful conclusion means, because I think it's important to indicate what that means. Successful conclusion means that you have received a favorable judgment from the court, or that you have settled a matter in a manner that the department feels there was value added in the process. So you haven't settled just for the sake of settling. You settled because there was value added. And sometimes we feel that there are cases that the prospect of success are such that you are forced to settle a lot earlier than going on the field to court, because you can see that your prospects are so in terms of the prospect of success. So the target was 75% in terms of the allocation. We missed a target, and we went back to the system to establish exactly why are we missing the target. Last year, you remember, we recall that we made the target, but this year we grew the target a bit and we missed it. So we have to find out why have we missed it, and the process is already in the department to send a response to that. Cases that were successfully concluded were much less than the target. And again, this is an area that we are looking at. I must just indicate this just on the issues of success, that it's going to be a journey, and it's not a competent issue on the side of the people that do the cases for and on behalf of the department. But it's more of
are issued. I don't know if I made that. The declaration before the instructions are issued on the case, that really lead us to having challenges in winning cases according to target. And if I can just also illustrate what do I mean by that, is that sometimes you look at the facts that are given as a state attorney, given to you as a state attorney, and you say, well, if I look at this, I don't know whether I can see my way to court just using these instructions. But your client insists that the matter must be taken all the way and to court. And state attorneys try, and I worked with them very closely in recent past because I really don't like being defeated by anybody, generally. That's just me. And I try to understand why are we always losing, and well, not always, but why are we losing? And so we have had to go back, and we're talking to our colleagues in government as well, just to ensure that they understand what it means. We are talking to them both in terms of the actual expense it costs us to fight cases that the prospects are not very first and foremost. Secondly, we are talking to cost, because mind you, they still have to pay us that money. But of course, we spend the money, they pay us later, and that is a problem for us. Secondly, we established, in particular, and it's going to be a program time penalty that we are going to roll out to other departments as well, but we prioritize three or four departments, staff, home affairs, health, and basic education. We started a project where we work on a monthly basis. We meet just to say, these are your cases, this is what is happening, and so on and so on. The in-NS that is working well with us now, but these are the target groups that are going to move to, because they are our biggest clients, as it were, in terms of the work that we do. And we find that these are areas where also we lose most of the cases just because of lack of headness. As I say, fundamentally, it's an area prior to instruction. But even after instructions, we've worked with state attorneys in the recent past just to say, please just read the documents. Don't just take the documents from an attorney and file them in court. So we sit days on end at night after work. We go through the papers. Especially, we can't do it with all the papers, but we look for priority cases that have big strategic outcomes for us, and we work on them. And sometimes I think with them myself, and just encourage, I think the defense is right for us to be able to succeed in those cases. I can't do it for other departments, though, but I can do it for my department, and the expectation is that other departments, the legal services, might also just do that level of drill before the cases are filed in court and are defended in court. In terms of the caseload, the biggest is home affairs, and basic education, and health. Those are the biggest.
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted you to one more clarify for me. As a matter of percentage of successfully completed cases, where your title is 50%. 50% of what? Now, could that mean that you are targeted to win 50% of the cases that you get involved with and lose the other? And of course, I realized that 314 million rand is money paid to CDI. I thought maybe it was the value of maybe the damages is like that we recovered, but the fee that has been paid to CDI is referred to the value that you get out of that. If you can elaborate a bit more, because my understanding of the state being facade to particularly in some CDI in order to give them more experience, give them more exposure, so that in the course of time they are on the same level as the others.
take the last question, the difficult one, I'm just kind of to respond to. The value as in growth, I take it, and the personal development and growth of the legal practitioner, I think that question is up to that. Indeed, I think there is value. I think we are getting value, and I think we can see people that we started working with hypothetically 3 years ago where they are today. The ideal is that people are able to give us better quality service, and less with some advocates we are able to have a service. And I'm going to talk anecdotally. Again, I'm going to talk anecdotally because we haven't done an analysis to say who's giving us good service, who's giving us bad service. We're going to check that. We're looking at the same future. We're going to check that. And we, anecdotally, there are few advocates that, just give an example, as a person I have worked with in particular areas, let's say labor matters, that I can tell you at any given point in time, if you said you're looking at labor, again, who's a junior, I'm not talking about SPs, I'm talking about just juniors, I can say without shade of doubt, X, because of the growth they've made and of the diligence they apply them, with which they apply themselves into the work they do, and of the way they draft the court papers, where you know that, I mean, really, when you read these papers, unless someone, and you read them against your opponent's papers, you can tell, you don't have to go to court for the court to judge, you can tell that they know they can pick these papers. And indeed, there are those people. And they are juniors, and that's the brilliance of the whole program, is that they are juniors, and you can see them develop. In labor matters, in commercial matters, I mean, we've just done one very big case, which I won't mention publicly, well, but it was recorded currently. I can tell you, we knew our papers way before they went to court. We knew. We told them, there is no way the judge can find differently. They don't need paper. Because we read the papers, we prepared thoroughly, we worked for days on end to just write proper papers. By the time they went to court, we knew. We told people, you will see it right here. And we will take this note on appeal because there's no way based on the appeal papers in our responding papers is the judge to give us anything different. And indeed, in all the methods that we've done in the past 2 months, 3 months, we've not come up short. And that's because we put the program in place because, as I say, losing is not enough. And we don't like and not so nice things.
Actually, some of the other questions that I want to ask with regard to this matter. The first question is, which government department does the tendency or not really brief in PDI? Because there is a tendency, we know that. Which ones are they? Which government department prefer briefing private counsel on a retainer basis? That also contributes to the whole skewed briefing patterns. You've indicated that only 90% of the 70% of briefs were allocated to females. Is there a target that you have for the year? Because the previous year was 18%, this year 19%. Are we supposed to be excited about the 1%? What is the target? Do you also have a criteria for appointing private attorneys? I would hope that there is preference for smaller firms, but smaller firms does not necessarily mean quality. And we all know quality is important because we want to win the cases. So is there a criteria, but also you did mention something about the one council that doesn't want to work with the other council, which is normal, it happens, but is there also a criteria for the appointment of senior as well as junior council? And why is it that some council can prefer to work with others and others don't? I mean, who really wants to work then? Then I want to talk about your paragraph B, paragraph B there, but I'm going to use the information on page 32 of the annual report, which is basically the same, it's not abbreviated as that. You say a total of 174 cases were finalized, with 918 cases settled, 570 cases won, and 400 lost, okay? those numbers don't add up for me, even though there's only a 14 difference, okay? But what I want to know is, if you say that 570, which comes to your 30%, I don't calculate the percentages, you've won, okay? In other words, you've lost 70%. Because you say that you've won 30%. What amount are we talking about? That whole 70% which the state lost, what amount are we talking about? But also, there was a case recently, Casima. Casima versus the Department of Transport. And I'm going to read you on page 21 what these judges have said. Indeed, the experience of each of the members of this full bench has been frequently and most disturbingly. Civil litigation against the state in this division is allowed to go by default. You don't make reference of any default. I don't know if the default falls under finalization or lost cases, but you don't talk about that. And it is true that what these judges are saying, because the impression that they create is that in the lower Gauteng High Court, Victoria, that basically all of the cases of where the state is involved goes past by default. I mean, it sends us a picture, but you don't talk about that. So if you can just answer those questions, if I just submit it on something else. Yeah, I'll come back to the, I mean, we're still going to talk about the state.
Chair, if I may take you to the previous question on cases successfully, I just want to add a few things about how we calculate successfully concluded cases. It's not all the cases that are handled by the state attorney, it's only those cases that are enrolled in court. So you'll find that there are also other cases that the state attorney deals with where we may have averted litigation. We do not calculate success rate on those cases, but only what went to court. And when a case is lost, I think it depends on a lot of issues, some of those being the facts of a particular case, the level of preparation, but also you will find that there are very important constitutional issues in the matter that must go to court and be decided upon because we are involved in jurisprudence. So naturally, we wouldn't like to lose those cases, but sometimes it happens that those are issues that need to be decided in court. That's in survival success rate. With regard to the criteria of briefing attorneys, I can answer that in with regard to how do we choose attorneys to be to represent the state. We definitely choose smaller firms. Because we want to ensure their sustainability and also the principle of empowerment applies there as well. On the criteria for appointment of senior and junior, I think it depends a lot on the legal services in each department in terms of how seniors and juniors get used. For example, in justice, if we leave a senior and if they come as a package with a junior and we find that it doesn't apply, if it's not in line with our policy, then we don't leave that senior. We actually insist that if we are leaving a male senior, we insist that it be a female. So it depends on the strength of the legal services department to insist that the policy of leaving 75% senior is applied. So if we insist on it, I think then we find that it does happen. And in fact, I think in justice, in the majority, all our junior counsels are female as well. So our figures speak very well in terms of how we empower female opinions. With regard to the default judgments, we do report on default judgments because it's just the target. And I think we can get those figures from our statistics and provide that. We do know of the Tatima case, but I think that was one of the, it was a very serious case, but I think it was an exception in terms of what was going on in that court in particular. I don't think the situation is as bad as it may be made up in that case, but we did put measures in place to try and resolve that issue. The target for women, our target is not 18 or 19%. In fact, it is much higher than that. It's just that that's what we achieved.
But I think I'd like us to bear in mind the percentage of women that are at the bar as well. It's a very low percentage in comparison to women. I think we provided those figures that not much has changed, but we can also get the updated version of that. Our target is 55% PDI, and in Germany we have a target of at least 50% women. And with regard to which departments don't get PDI, I think DG would have to give a, we'd have to look at the facts and give a more, we have an idea in our minds, but I wouldn't like us to go by that. And by what we think is the position, the drivers, the figures. And also on retailers as well, we also have our suspicion of who uses council on retailers, but we'd like to provide the actual steps.
Just to add on the issue that the issue of retainers, let me start there. On the issue of retainers, we discourage, maybe let me start by saying, discourage the use of retainers. We think it's a lot of money, which is wasted, because those people, half the time, whatever those people are paying for, either never happens, or if it does, by the time it happens, a lot of money has already been lost. And so we discourage that. We discourage, in fact, I think we've been very aggressive in the past financial year against retainers. It doesn't mean they don't obtain on the ground, but whenever people have asked to appoint someone on retainer, we have said no. And even where we knew that information came to our attention, in some areas we terminated the contract, and in others we looked to the relevant issues and we said we would like that person to be out of the retainer. But we haven't done it with everybody else, because naturally we will have to get information to get to everybody else in good time. So that's the first issue I wanted to raise. But I really want to go back to the issue of the North Counting High Court, because we put in place a lot of intervention. The Kadima case was not the best of cases to have had, had a judgment like that against us. And perhaps I need to just explain what was, not what was the context of Kadima, but what had obtained in the state attorney office in Pretoria in particular. Just like every other areas in our department, from time to time we've had an area that has just no capacity. Earlier we were talking about the family advocate, and you saw the performance of the family advocate directly related to Karafuti. Similarly, in the office of the state attorney in Pretoria, basically in the state attorney period, we had serious capacity constraints, generally. But in the state attorney Pretoria in particular, last year in particular, we had a lot of growth of work, and of course we did not have capacity. Two reasons for lack of capacity. One is historic, the office has just not grown, while other areas in the department have grown, because, and there was a reason for that, other areas like your vulnerable groups, there were new pieces of legislation that needed people to be put in place in those areas. So those areas were prepared because they're driven by legislation, compared to the state attorney where there was nothing that was driving a demand for staff members to be employed as state attorney. So, and it's historic, and that is why I'm saying state attorney in general. Secondly, what is obtained in the state attorney in Pretoria in particular is that, but again this is common, but in particular in Pretoria, is that we had a lot of people had retired and were out of the system, and we could not appoint at those levels at which they had retired, because they always in process. This is where you see it in action, because we couldn't appoint certain levels, and I think it's level 10 that we were not, 9 and 10 that we were not able to appoint because of the, I don't know the English word, because that process was frozen, that level was frozen in the DPSA process. I don't know whether that makes sense. So we had that problem, and therefore we couldn't refresh that capacity, and we still don't. We can't refresh that capacity. Thirdly, even in terms of our own financial and budgeting allocation in-house, we had had serious challenges in terms of how we had allocated those funds to the state attorney by other capacities other than the levels that I've already spoken about. So if you put together all these elements, you then realize that obviously we were bound to, because at some point we weren't going to be able to keep this going on for some time. Now, the honourable members would recall that we then published, our minister published a transformation of state legal services. It's primarily aimed at that. And the document speaks to the issue that has been raised by the honourable member. In fact, pretty much all the issues that have been raised by the honourable member, other than the logistical issues that you raised. So the one area that this transformation wants to look at, and very urgently, is to look at bringing standardization and the creation of norms on how the state attain works. Now, if I just want to move you away from the state attain and look at other areas where we've created norms in the ICT environment, in the department, we've created norms, not completely, but in some areas that we were more conservative, we've created norms in the PDF environment, we've created norms in finance, and so similarly, we have to get to the point where we create norms and standards in the state attainment environment. So that is the one issue. Secondly, we want to train and bring people up to speed. Thirdly, we don't want document pushers. We want state attainers to get out there and to do their work. And so we want to appoint people to the state attainers. And we want the state attainers to be proud of being state attainers. That's like everybody else work wherever they work. They are proud of being what they are. So that's the broader transformation that will apply to all the state attainers. But specifically to the interventions that were made in the Victoria office, and to a certain extent in the Johannesburg office, is we gave them support capacity, administrative support capacity, because state attorney must run to court and must come back and do the administration, and that takes a lot of time. So we've given them some level of administrative support. It's not adequate by far, but it's there now. We've given it to them, and you can see the performance is beginning to turn around, even with the small intervention. We gave them additional money to buy additional state attorney capacity. And they done that. I'm not sure of the numbers, but you can ask the numbers. We'll give you the numbers when we go back. Thirdly, we in areas where they were lacking the infrastructure equipment, we've adjusted as much as we were able to. I cannot recall all the interventions, but those interventions, Chair, have already been put in place, so that we can turn the situation around as a holding mechanism. One, the bigger transformative issue in the state legal service is to then bring in the Solicitor General from the top, who will then drive the transformative agenda in the state attorney part, drive excellence. More excellence in the state attorney is going to be needed in the next 10 to 20 years. Of the NDP. Hopefully the balance of the outer 10 years will take care of itself. We believe that if we don't do that, we aren't going to change this paradigm. And indeed, I agree, it is a paradigm, and our minister has been briefed on the exigency of the interventions that are necessary. We've had several engagements with National Treasury on the need for prioritized funding to address the turnaround in the state government environment, and I hope that assists you. She will speak to the numbers again. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and the honourable members. We note the error there. We try our best to ensure that there are no errors. We got 250 pages of numbers and words and everything to confirm. And a few cases will be clearer, but we sincerely apologize for that. We will then present the correct number figure of the 1,888 that has been noted. We will then put it as an error term on that. But you indicated that 30% is part of the incident. What is 30%? Then, you know, by that decision, it would be 1,304. But you will...
Because I think it's their question tagged onto Honourable Ngozi Olumekwa's question as well, in terms of what value have we suffered or what value have we gained. I think it speaks to the same thing. If you look at the
at the cases generally that we deal with, and we'll provide a written report. If you look at the cases that we deal with, the value you generally establish from your total call it contingent liability in cases that you have not concluded, and in terms of cases that you concluded, in whether you recovered something as damages, including legal costs, or you lost something as damages, including legal costs. And in most cases, just as a principle, that's how we would articulate that this is the value we actually saved for the state or lost for the state, as the case may be. Now, if I use just as an example, the number of cases that we receive, and I'm using this as just as an example, from SAP, there are very few big cases that we receive from SAP as a client. But the smaller cases that we receive are so much high in number and very low in value. But when taken together, they can give you a huge number of costs to the state, as it were. And that's how we work out the thing. So when we give you a written document on that, please take that into account. That in any time, a big case you'll have two or three big cases. The rest of the cases will be small, annoyingly small, but a lot of them. So in home affairs, as an example, the most cases we get are refusals of asylum cases, tons of them. In fact, as an example, we get the cases such as your arrest for those types of offences, which ordinarily in the bigger scheme of things wouldn't be in these other cases, but the total value when you talk about the quantum and the quantity of cases then it becomes quite high. But perhaps the point that I'm trying to get to is it then tells you how many state attorneys you ought to have in the system to be able to deal with just that border if for nothing else. You need a lot of state attorneys, but you also want your state attorneys to grow. And when we are then talking about growth, they can't just be doing sub-cases. They must also be doing like serious general type cases and those types of cases for their own individual growth and confidence as well. And that's the balance, the transformation agenda in the state legal policy we are seeking to achieve.
Just a follow-up with regards to those state attorney's office. I just want to know, the lead here, can you say that none of the offices are dysfunctional? And I'm using that word because it was used in the by one of the state attorneys in that Tasima case. But are there, so I basically want to know is, can you sleep peacefully at night knowing that there's none of the offices, the state attorney's offices, that that needs urgent attention and that
the effect of the function of the earth. I just wanted to know when you give a brief of data as to what categories of cases we have where the state attorney is the applicant and where
the thank you. Can I sleep at well at night? But I don't sleep, so that's a good thing. look, Pretoria was the biggest higher risk area. Johannesburg was a higher risk, but as I say, we kind of put measures in place to they remain a risk, but not as high a risk as they were last year at the time of that judgment. Secondly, the in the eastern case, there are still higher risk areas. It remains a higher risk. It remains a high risk, but again, it's a high risk that has been brought to our attention. Let me just say that at any given point in time, any office could move from being a low risk area to being a high risk area. So it's not an indictment on those people who are sitting there. It's just a high risk in terms of the volumes of what they're getting into those areas and the number of state attorneys that are there. So it's not the credibility of those people that I'm speaking to right now, and I don't want, by the time I leave here, my colleagues feel that I'm said they are hired because of that, because they aren't. But secondly, just as I conclude the point, in terms of the quality of the state attorney, I have worked in the recent past, because in any organization you can't reach every area of the organization in 1 year, but since I turned my attention to the state attorney, I've worked with the most incredible brains in the state attorney, and sometimes we sit over well over 12 midnight and we chat and I say, but guys, you're not working, you're not talking about some of the different work that you're doing, because when you then go through the tables, you realize that these people are way intelligent and they are way hardworking. It's just that they just have so much to do, and sometimes it's not always humanly possible for them to do the work that they do. And I must indicate that, you know, you have to make any environment attractive for you to achieve good results. And even in private sector, I come from there, and I will be this negatively, but when you work in some part of town, even if you're an intelligent person, when you work in some part of town, people are like, no, they want to talk to people who are working in some part of town. So you have to make your environment attractive, and that's the point I want to reach. That unfortunately, our resources are not able to make our environment in the state that's in right now to be better attractive, but we are working on it. The final point is that we want to turn this thing around, even as though we have an obligation and we will continue to use a private sector real resources, not real resources, like a company, like an organization, private sector legal professionals to support our work. But we really want to turn the matrix around, and we want a lot of the work that must be done to be done by the state attorney, that we use those resources to address the deficiencies in capacity. And that's what the nature that we are trying to achieve. Applicants and respondents will provide that information in the written form as we provide that. Thank you very much.
I'm glad we have this little engagement on this matter. Significantly, it did form part of your briefing with DG, but significantly, during yesterday's interviews in Education Service, five women were interviewed for a post on the bench and the three of those five were white, and two were from the previously disadvantaged group. The person who was appointed is Judge McCormick. But what is of significance is the fact that all five women said more or less the same thing. That had South Africa a woman in their position. As things stand, firstly, it is expected of them to do family labor. That's it. They're all citizens. And that the old boys network, the boys club, extremely strong, and they ensure that women don't get beat, which is not true. Now, it's not the other ladies or anyone else, and it's five women being interviewed for a very senior position. You see, did you, I hear what you're saying about experience. And one of the ministers, the minister on the case, made the point to me informally and said, look, their first prize is to win their cases. And I think we understand that. So if they choose to appoint a Gauntlet or an Ultown, I don't think anyone would object, but the condition to that must be that the junior must be someone from the previous minister. And I don't see why that shouldn't be set down as a condition, which comes back to the question that happens, which is, why are they being allowed to dictate to the state who must be the tutor? So you can't get briefings because you lack experience, and you won't get that experience until you get the briefing. So then eventually you have a frustrated a group of people who've gone through all the trouble of studying to become lawyers and employing the time. I'm looking forward with a lot of enthusiasm to this role dealing with this agenda. And I sincerely hope that it's going to solve all these problems. And I'm also encouraged to send this for the law society and individual professional agenda. I'm encouraged by the fact that you intend to pursue the limited female baby by engaging the profession. I'm going to be very curious to hear, in a year from now, what the responses were that you received, and particularly that. I'm going to be very curious. Because if it was an old boy's letter, that's where you go. And they tend to speak very aristocratic terms about merit, as though a woman can't attain it. So I really, DJ, would also like to see, I hear anything you've said. My understanding of the State Attorney's Office is not limited. Provincial government and local government, does it cover that? I'd also like to see being extended to state-owned entities. I don't see one. Because if you mention that these small cases, and then you have those very big cases, in the state-owned entities, more often than not, they are very big cases, and we go a long way to providing the kind of experience that we are demanding women lawyers to have. Percentage of women at the bar, well, I don't know, that's something that has to be pushing in advance. I can't think of a solution. But clearly, if you look at the profession, it's not woman-friendly. It's not. The message is very clear. Stay out. Or elsewhere. And so as a consequence, the percentage of women as far as being very low. So yes, DG, that's my personal view. And when you receive the bill, I hope that covers that. I don't know. I sincerely hope that the policy extends to provincial government, local government, and state agencies. That's a lot of work. We'll be watching this with great interest. It'll be a while before the Solicitor General comes into existence. So in this intervening period, we can't sit back with our understanding and say, and the bill's coming. But by then, the situation may worsen.
Thank you very much, Chair, and taking the spirit that you have given. The applicability of the services of the state attorney, whether they go to the provinces and on the way to local government and to state-owned enterprises, the answer is yes. But in theory, the answer is yes. In practice, the answer is no. And if I say no, I don't mean no completely. But if you don't take your space in anything, just generally, some people will move in and take your space. And I do think that because the state attorney for many years had focused itself to servicing national government, to a certain extent provincial government, but when you get local government, they really have not been there. find that in some areas local governments use us, but in some areas they don't. But the policy framework that I'm talking about, which will require a lot of capacitation for it to work effectively, it then includes everybody that has been identified by the chair, which means state-owned enterprises, local government, provincial and national government. But obviously, it will be a progressive process, given the capacity that currently obtains in our environment. And how we build that, how quickly we are able to build that capacity going forward. So that's going to be the biggest test, if ever there was a test. The real profession, I would argue, is not known for excitement when it comes to issues of transformation. It takes forever to transform anything. And it's not a criticism. I just think that people in the profession are somewhat conservative by nature. And so we just have to work very hard in the next few years to end the point. But everything else that has been said, we assess fully without reservation. And again, Chair, one of the arguments that was raised, because also the Minister consults quite widely with the legal profession, primarily during the legal practice bill, but also because of obviously he has links with the profession. The many reasons that were raised against or as result that have resulted in more people migrating away from the bar and even from the legal profession who were in private practice have been identified as them just not getting work from government. Now, our view may be interpreted to be somewhat controversial. Our view is that indeed people not get work from government, and there's no debate about that. But our view is that the person must be facilitated in such a way that in the medium to long term, they can diversify their offerings and get private clients and get some clients from government as well. So the question is, how quickly can people be put in place to be able to diversify and turn around and say, look, I won't take that brief because I have a brief from a big private client right now. And that's the idea that we want to see when people can pick and choose the work that they'd like to do. We aren't there, and I think the next 20 years is going to be very telling in how quickly we drive this and target so that at least we can get to the desired end state that is desired by the NDP. In terms of building that capacity, both in the state and also in the profession itself. We do have a duty, we believe. We do have a duty to nurture the profession to a particular point, but we also do believe that people must get to a point where they can move and are able to get different options whilst the new ones are coming into the system. And we want to make that attractive and for everybody, both from the private sector as well as the public sector. Thank you very much. This is the love of my life. The expansion, I love this one. If I do nothing, then to see expansion, I'll be very happy. Expansions, we have not been tracking for many years, and we've just been doing it in the post. I didn't open for employment, but it's a lot of work. It's just a lot of work. It's very administrative. It's a lot of work, and it's boxes and boxes that I get. And sometimes the expectation is that when a person applies, they will get their criminal record expunged the following week or the following month. And indeed, once we've cleared out our own establishment as a department, maybe that will happen. But at this stage, it's somewhat challenging to pull out this work. But we've really done very, very well. Just to give you an indication, in 2011-2010 financial year, we received 7,576 cases, and the growth in 2012-2013 financial year, we received 7,846. So you can tell that there's a lot of work that
very one aspect. Our obligation as a department, other than the physical act of expanding those criminal records, our obligation is to ensure that those people are able to get decent jobs wherever they are and are not limited by the criminal record. And after 10 years, they have done their part in terms of taking a punishment for it. And we believe that as quickly as we are able to bring them back to the economic mainstream, the better. That is the one aspect that we are trying to push. Having said that, the challenge we are having is that there are people who apply for expansion who have much more than one criminal record. Some have 15, some have 20, they just have so many criminal records. And therefore, when you look at the numbers of certificates issued, don't think we issued less certificates. Sometimes you issue one expungement and the person is left with another 15 that they still have to visit you on, either because they came too early, because the other ones they've not finished the 10 years, or others are not expungable, so they must go through a different process. But you still have to expunge the ones that you must expunge before they go through a different process. It's a lot of work. It's volume, it's boxes that come to my office pretty much every day that I go through and check and expunge. So that is the one element. But it's just been my pride and joy in the sense that, when you don't work for the Department of Justice and you don't know these small things, the impact they make in people's lives. And when you do it, then you realize, wow, with this record in expunged, this person is able to go and study in Germany. They can't go and study because they have this criminal record. They can't start a business because they have this criminal record. It's so amazing once it's done, when people then write back to you and say, thank you, I'm now in wherever, doing whatever. It's very, very fulfilling. That is hard work. In terms of the actual performance, I think we performed a lot better than we did last year, and the certificates are not issued, as indicated, do not reflect any poor performance at all, and I think we're going to be tracking this work going forward. In terms of pardons, we've received 1,164 pardons applications, and of those, 944 applications were finalized, and when we say they were finalized, we are talking about them getting out of our system completely and moving to the next level, which is the level of the president, because as you know, the pardons are dealt with by the office, by that office. But we push as many as we have been able to push, and we are confident that, and honorable members, we would also know that we have, in these two areas, we have had a number of backlogs over a long time, and we try to just go and pay particular attention so that we can reduce the state law advisory services is a different ballgame altogether. It's the most exciting work in the department, but very challenging work. In 2010, we sat down and we said this work we had not established. Developed targets for. It was just work done, and we were all very happy that the work was being done. But with obviously the new accounting metrics, we need to account for the things that we do, especially if we have even money for those things. So in developing our target in the first instance, it was a challenge because we had no baseline information. It's one of the areas that we had no baseline information. In strict sense, we knew roughly how much what we were doing and how long it took us, but we didn't have strict baseline information. So we said we'll start with the number of work and the number of days we think it must take us to do that work. We don't know whether we've done that right, because we are still busy developing the proper baselines as we move on. So it's something that we are watching very carefully going forward. But as you can see, we were able to meet our targets in most of the areas. Where we have not met the targets, we have not missed them by much. The only area I would like just to speak to is the last area, which is the translations that are finalized within the turnaround time. And the turnaround time was 55 days. Now, because of the volumes of work that the Chief State Law Advisor Practice does, the translations are as needed, and any translations, they must meet certain requirements in terms of the parameters that are now set out by the Department of Arts and Culture. Yeah, and they therefore that has begun to be a challenge. And in terms of just the total number of people who are in place and the volume of work that are coming that is coming in, it's an area that we must look at. But we've developed expertise in this area, and we are confident that going forward we are going to be meeting these targets and surpassing them by different margins. International legal relations, other than just dealing with issues of extradition that are set out there, in the recent past, our primary focus has been just getting out those extradition applications within what we thought is a reasonable period of 3 years. And again here, it's the new baseline we are developing because we were doing the work but we never really quite measured how long does it take us. And in the past 2 years, we are beginning to see a trend that either these targets are reachable or they're not reachable at this point. Our view is that we will retain the targets that we set probably for the next 2 or 3 years. That should give us solid baseline for us to target going forward. I'm comfortable that even though we have not met the deadline in terms of targets, but we've done as much work as has been necessary for those areas and transition and mutual legal assistance for us to have an impact. And I must indicate, Honourable Member, that even though a lot of people bash us for lack of settlement, we've been receiving very good accolades in these areas of work, in particular in from other countries where extradition are moving very swiftly now, the mutual legal assistance. It's equally very strictly, and we are comforted by that. Now we have to come to
No, I'm not blaming you, DG, or your department. But, anyway, let's proceed with your
check.
Yes,
the question on the fight for mutual legal defense and extradition. How many were approved in both instances?
We will provide the number of the declined ones. The majority of them are approved, but yes, indeed, there are those that are declined. There are a few that ring in bells almost immediately because I know about them, but we will pull the numbers and provide them either before the end of the session or as soon as possible after we leave the session.
Here's a question, do we also get the same kind of cooperation as we give to this country?
Yeah, I've been wondering about that.
In the main, and I'm speaking anecdotally, but in the main, we have been receiving similar cooperation in the main, but there are countries who I'm not sure whether I'm at liberty to mention, so I won't. But there are countries who in specific areas have given us a runaround. And let me just specify the area, not the country. There are countries that have not repealed the death sentence. And when their people are here, and they have to be extradited, and we need them to give us assurance that those people will not be subjected to capital punishment, then we don't get as much cooperation. But when we want to extradite people to our country, other than what is playing out in the UK right now, we have been relatively happy with the cooperation we are receiving. Thank you. We're not the portfolio committee has been pleased with in the legal practice field. We honestly appreciate that. We didn't think this was easy, but thank you for putting the energy into it. It's really an important deal for us, and it took us forever to put it in place so that it is ready for Parliament. And sometimes we can't help but feel sorry for Parliament. But overall, we've done a lot of drafting, and we are the first one to say we are very grateful, for instance, for Parliament having finalized the Superior Court and the 17th Constitutional Amendment. It's given us a huge break for us to be able to finalize the work on the work to start officially with the work of the transformation of the judiciary. Similarly, we are looking forward to the work of this Honourable House and Parliament in general on the finalization of the legal practice bill. The torture, implementing of torture of persons bill, as well as the human rights bill, and all the things that are put before on the slide, is work that has occupied us during the period under review. We were able to finalize some, and we did not finalize other than, and really, it's just through sheer volume of work that the drafters in the department have had to deal with in their own space, but also in support of Parliament in terms of coming and explaining the bill and the bills and all of that. It takes inordinate amount of hours in a day to be able to then go back and finish all the work that they must also finalize. In addition, they also do a lot of drafting of regulations, and so which may not necessarily make their way to Parliament, but they are still required, and it's also as a next. So we did not meet the target. It's a long way of telling that we didn't meet the target. We are very conscious of this. Our menu of requests of legislation to be developed is always surpass the capacity we could ever put in place as department. But indeed, our capacity has been somewhat constrained in the past year in the environment. We've only just filled the capacity of the DPG in that case, and not that that will change a lot in terms of just the numbers of bills that we have seen. We are looking forward to Chair was speaking just now about the State Attorney Amendment Act, or the act that will bring about the Solicitor General, and I thought I would deal with that issue when it comes to legislative development. What we had thought we would do was we thought we would do an overhaul of the State Attorneys Act, but doing that has proven very difficult in the context of everything else that is urgent that we needed to deal with. But we needed the state for the Solicitor General to be appointed as early as yesterday. And so we will be, I think, through Cabinet this week, either today or tomorrow, I don't know what is today, but through Cabinet this week, through a Cabinet committee, we will be presenting the amendment to the State Attorney Act, which only seeks to introduce the appointment of the Solicitor General so that we can get that process going. And the balance of the work we will do is the total either revamp of the State Attorney Act or the introduction of the act that will be dealing with the transformed legal services will then come in the new year. But we thought at least if we can get that bit going, we will do that. So as I say, it's going through the Cabinet processes right now. I don't know what to say about the Nuclear Marriages Bill. It's a bill that has a lot of love and a lot of hate. from the relevant community who sometimes get left with not knowing whether this bill is wanted or not wanted by the affected community. We've had almost 50% for and 50% against, and the threat that we get in pushing this bill sometimes worries us that they may be potentially still left. But that's not why we haven't finalized the work. We just have not had sufficient capacity to finalize the work. But it is an area that I think this Honorable House might want to just think about and guide us on, because where you have such diverse and opposing interests as strong as these are, it becomes very difficult to know whether it would receive an easy passage as Parliament. So I thought I'd raise that issue just out of interest. Legal Aid Bill is now just finalized. It's gone through the cabinet processes as well, but we did not meet the target, and it wasn't due to lack of trying. That amendment of the Legal Aid Bill, we sat in consultation with the Minister in Legal Aid a few times with National Treasury, few times with other departments, and it went in all the way to all the cabinet and came back, and it really has been a difficult amendment, but we have eventually found each other, and so the bill has been finalized in this current financial year. The dissemination of remuneration for Chapter 9 institutions has also been one of the difficult areas. There has been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and pushback, but we were able to then finalize it for submission to cabinet. Oh, wonderful. Thank you. I have not had that part. I'm glad to hear it. The hate speech bill, in about 3 weeks ago from now, we had a workshop on the LGBTI community, and we indicated to them that the hate speech policy is all but done, and we are seeking permission to cabinet soon to publish it for comment. But it's kind of behind the scenes, we've worked on the theory that is tailored according to the draft that we've already done on the policy, and if we get permission to publish it, that request is in the system of cabinet as I speak. So hopefully we'll be able to get the bill as soon as possible after that process submitted to Parliament. We have had a serious delays on the NPA amendment bill, and we won't make the target for this year at all. For the under review, we didn't make the target, and we aren't going to make the target for this year at all. There are more issues that are emerging that would require a lot more conversations between various departments, not least of which finance, to be able to get the amendments that we thought we would get in this. I think there would be three problems. The problem that you've already identified, the consultation issue, is but one of them. The second relates to just understanding and appreciating the accountability of the NPA. In other words, clearing the role of the NPA and DPP, vis-à-vis the NPA CEO, vis-à-vis the DG Justice. We move to a certain point, and when other issues
imagine, you know, in that space, the building that brought back to say, no, relook at this thing, because maybe the matrix of accountability is not as clear and probably not as strong. So it's not, it's just surely, I guess, the apprehension in the system that when you make the CEO account in the same way as the DD account administratively vis-a-vis the MDPP, you might have a recipe for some level of conflict, because the one controls the financial resources, the one controls the prosecutorial decision, and we have to find a matrix that will avoid a potential conflict between those two within the institution, and be satisfied that that matrix will work.
The spoken word above the actual
Was somewhat delayed. We took a bit of time to appoint the commission, but it has since been appointed and it's in operation. So it's currently going to be reviewing all the previous work that has been done by the commission previously, and we then guide on which projects and how quickly can those long outstanding projects be finalized, because they have been projects that have been in place for far too long. And it is the commission that leads that area of work. Now, the work insofar as the National Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities is ongoing, and it's ongoing within the commission. That is work that we are beginning to be under pressure on, and that was the very reason why the commission was requested, even as it's met for the first time, I think. Was it that? 3 weeks ago, to try and look at those outstanding projects so that we can finalize them. Now, there were those bills that were dealt with very urgently, that we are very grateful that Parliament has put us with. The 17th Constitution Amendment Bill and the Superior Court Bill, which are now both the Prevention and Combat to Trafficking Legislation, the Protection from Harassment Act, the Criminal Law Amendment Act, and really for this one we couldn't thank you more than we are, because really it averted what would have been a disastrous situation, and thank you for that. The Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, the Criminal Procedure, as well as the Sheriff, and I love the Sheriff Act, because it really enabled so many sheriff appointments to be made, and we now continue to make appointments of sheriff, and we believe that hopefully we will address the issue of service or non-service of progress much better with that. It really was came when it was happening to me. The same branch did a lot of subordinate legislation during the period under review.
Yeah, but we all picked it up. Yeah. You get the point, though.
Gracias.
I know, Chair, that it is before the assembly, but I think eventually in our interest as we consider the report of the party to know, because we interact with the relevant bodies, with the FC, within the before Parliament.
I agree. I fully, fully agree. It ought to have been in the bucket of this, and I understand that it's not.
And I take it to know what you traditionally when you approach.
Thank you, but it is indeed in the NPOP, and the is good work that is happening behind the scenes on the day. So it will match from the NPOP, I guess, once the NPOP has done its work. But I do apologize that it was not really. So we've dealt with the regulations. The most outstanding regulation was the one that we needed to deal with for the judicial conduct tribunal to be put in place, because it had an outstanding for a very long time. Then I move to conclusions of our presentation. Even before touching on to the conclusion that are written, I think that it would be important to recall where we have been and where we are today, and to indicate that it's a journey, it's a very treacherous journey, but it's a journey nonetheless, and if we have to get to the horizon of the 2030 National Development Plan, it means we must have stayed the course all the time. We've made significant strides in implementing the policy initiatives, in particular related to the transformation of the judiciary, the transformation of civil services, as well as putting in place the sexual offences court. But as I've indicated, there is a lot more work now that must happen in practice, in terms of building capacity in all those areas, and in terms of putting the relevant controls and procedures and operational and implementation manuals to get the work going in those environments. In particular, we really are looking forward to the work that will be done by the Special Offenses Court to fight the scourge against the violation, in particular, of children, but the violation of women and children. In general, including of course the LGBTI community, because some of them fall in that category. We really want to move as the Department of Justice and be in control of that environment, and I don't mean in control of judicial decisions, but I mean in control of providing the necessary support that we can provide in the sexual offences court so that they function optimally. But I do think that remains the broader fight on violence against women, on sexual offences against women and children. It's really a societal issue that must be driven not just by the Department of Justice or government, but also by it must be driven at all levels of society. And it would make our work a lot more better if that conversation were to go out to the South Africans at all levels. We've made an impact in the people's lives that we serve by just offering the efficiencies that we have been working on, and in particular those efficiencies in the maintenance environment, in the master's environment, in the default judgment environment, in the taxation environment. If we can sustain those initiatives, we do believe that the impact will be felt far and wide. And we do want to give members of public assurance that we are improving our governance systems in the department and that they can have a measure of comfort that the resources that we get given by Parliament and resources that we get given by any other body that offers us whatever form of resources are utilized in the manner that they were intended to be utilized. And we want to just give that comfort to South Africans. We are grateful for the assistance that this portfolio committee in particular, actually I must say this now that I'm just about to finish the presentation, that we listen sometimes when people talk about their portfolio committees and we just wonder, because ours is supposed to have, we don't understand the problems they have. And we really want to thank you for that. You make us work very hard and we prepare very hard when we come to the committee. Sometimes we trip over ourselves trying to prepare and send the right message to the Honourable House. But we believe that we've received unparalleled guidance from this Honourable House to be able to do our work. And what we appreciate even more is that the committee has also given us space to do the work. It's very important that we get space to do the work. Otherwise, if the committee is all over us, it becomes very difficult to find time to do the work in the end. So we want to appreciate that in NS. We also want to just indicate that the development issues are major and are far from being resolved, and we need to stay the course in sustaining the message in getting those issues resolved. Yesterday I gave this Honourable House just a glimpse of the presentation we made to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, where we were called upon to account why we were not paying within 30 days in all instances. We gave a very comprehensive presentation to them, and the committee was satisfied about the initiatives we are making and how we are trying to turn the corner on that, but it insisted that we must make those interventions a little faster and ensure that people are not out of business just because of the department fault not paying within the state. And we want to point that it's an agenda that we monitor on every other week, because our ex meets twice a month. The one ex for the performance month and week, and the other ex deals then with the issues of strategy and where we are and the life issues. But these challenges that we put as Roman numeral 5 continue to play us as we speak. And we don't see our way very clear of resolution. The current contract, the security contract that is in place now, is one of those contracts that is a clear indication of where we are with the funds. And so when you hear all the stories that you've been hearing in the past 2 or 3 days, please locate what you hear in that paragraph, because it's the biggest challenge in the area of our business. I'd like to really appreciate generally the support that we've also received from the minister, and because you rub shoulders better with him than we do, we would really wish to extend our gratitude to him and to the deputy minister. We really want to extend our hands publicly, because without their guidance, this work would have been not possible. It would have been 10 times more difficult. Obviously, we meet with a lot of other portfolio committees who call us to account for one reason or the other. We thank them as well, because as the questions that were raised in this meeting, as an example, and the questions that are raised in other meetings make us to go back and try and understand our business better, and we are grateful for that. And obviously everybody else, all our stakeholders, we thank a lot. But I really want to end by saying the staff in the Department of Justice do not always get the recognition that for the good work that they do. In the past years of my experience, we have absolutely fantastic people to work with who give their all pretty much all the time. And indeed, things do go wrong, as they should. But we manage those things that do go wrong. And staff have really come to the fore and we have worked like a team. And we do sometimes have a feeling that we could easily be untouchable if we fix just here and there and capacitate here and there. And I really have had an honor of working with the most wonderful team of EXCO and the most wonderful team of staff. And I really want to give assurance to this honorable house that you do have capacity in the Department of Justice that you can tap into from time to time if you should need assistance at a technical level that you could offer. Thank you very much.
Come up while I wasn't here yesterday afternoon when Mr. Daniels and I were doing something else that was interesting. the appointment of the service provider for the assessment of the impact of decisions of the two high courts. Our research shows that whereas 2.5 million has been budgeted for it before, that is now left to 2 million. Is that correct? If so, why? And our research also writes, now that you've appointed SSLC and Nelson Mandela to the law, would you like to tell us why they might? That would be very interesting. And also, our researchers said they are also looking at something which I've never seen in the terms of reference or in the whole lead up to the process, i.e. the powerful orientation of courts in other developmental such as Brazil and India. Is that correct? Where did it come from? Yeah, it wasn't in the terms of reference. So the first, why did they meet? And this new item on marijuana and the arms deal, again, I'm sorry if it came up before, but what did the president do? Is it just the same as in the last written update you gave us, that you will be wanting help out of the adjustment appropriation? Because all of this is unfunded, and it comes also away from it, doesn't it? Will you be asking our help for the adjustment budget? What order of funds are you looking for? And then if the other political question, right at the start of your presentation, you referred to the technical support which you give to the chapter 9. I'm trying to form an opinion what you think for. And they've both of you all grown up and doing everything on their own. And just if I may come back to the problem I raised in other years, afterwards given court orders for the issue is the ground cutting high court, or is that all fixed up? I would be delighted to know whether it's all resolved.
Arrested
in charge. Arrested before, if you remember what the judge wanted to do, I don't know, but the next time I went back in the corridor as well, at working here. And this is a very specific phenomenon of being on the floor to all this.
Thank you.
Thank
you
very much, Chen.
They're supposed to be small questions. They're not small.
the opponent was done, and we had only budgeted for 10 million, but all the proposals came, we had only budgeted for 2.5 million, and all the proposals came to way much more money than that. And after much processing, we decided to direct some of the prioritized subsidized with until some funds and research to be able to get the work started. And I thought actually you are correct. Secondly, why did they win? I have to go and look at the papers again. I can't remember everything else that was written in the submission, but we will be happy to give you that information. And whether the terms of reference dealt with the issue of the COPOA, I can't remember that from the top of my head, but if you go to the policy document that spoke to this work, you remember that document that was published?
Very well.
Yes. It does speak to the issue of benchmarking and looking, I don't know whether I mentioned India and Brazil by name, but it says comparable jurisdictions and say something to that, something else. I will have to go back and just read it and double check, but I do recall something like that in the document. We would provide that work, that response in writing. And then on Marikana IPP, well, our position remains, well, I don't know whether it remained unchanged until I was informed by the chief director in finance that there is some information. I don't know whether it's public, but I think he will be able to speak. The small technical support that we provide chapter 9 institutions, each year, and this varies from institution to institution, but I might want to say this. You know, each year when institutions must submit their budget, so it happens. And so sometimes we do provide technical support to them to do that. And other related issues, we do assist them quite significantly in those areas. And I said technical areas deliberately because we don't deal with the issues that they do. And then fraudulent court orders, in the recent past, I know none that has been issued. We've been managing the state quite strongly. And so, no, I can say this, no. Yeah, we believe in process. We also believe that if we find one, it will be in an isolated case and we will deal very decisively with them. But indeed, people do get disciplined and people do get arrested. And in fact, not for court orders necessarily, for failing court orders, but in that court in particular, we've had people arrested, and I think we've had one of them convicted for 6 years for doing this. I think last year was the end of the financial year. I think the period was 6 years in South House in Hong Kong. But a few of them, in fact, we've had, in that environment, we've had good successes towards the end of last year. We had that one who was transferred to Cali Safe, he who was convicted for many years, and the other one coming from that state was also convicted for many years. So it takes time, but eventually we are seeing improvement on that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the full presentation, very informative. And I just like to just have a few questions. Some of them you can answer, some of them you can just take note. I know you're tired. You actually reported on international legal relations, and I thought you were going to also include international human rights instruments. We're going to include part of financial support as a country. Maybe you can comment about it. Also, yesterday you actually talked about areas where you actually didn't have enough money to do work, and that was relating to some of the activities you had to add on after your objection. And I want to know if, and then you actually also indicated that the problem also is exacerbated by the budget cut, because now you're going to be cut instead of the budget. So I want to know at what point, in terms of the budget development project, you get to know how to cut. And then when it comes to additional activities, I wonder to what extent we have objectives that are such that we've grown up, then to manage to bring in anything that we're going to do with your mandate, without that being a problem. In terms of cancellation of the private-public partnership contract that time, where you had to use your internal staff, has actually helped to make a saving? And if you have an idea of that, yeah, I'm just curious to know. The audit action plan, which came out of the audit analysis report, the steering policy. And I think what is quite important is that it used not to be something that's been focused on previously, but now it's being focused on, and I think it's very important in terms of monitoring of risk assessment or risk management. What is the last one? Anyway, we've got those now.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the international human rights instruments, in general, we are celebrating the one that we've already adopted as a country. But let me just and then give you an indication of the ones that we have prioritized. We have a list here, so that I don't know whether we've made a link to be able to bring it up. We have the ICER report, which is the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. We submitted a report to Cabinet, and Cabinet approved it. We have forwarded that report to the Department of Arts and Culture for editing, because then that report must serve within the international human rights.
You don't have to tell about the state where these all of these instruments are. You know, what I mean is that in the future, everyone will report to communicate. We have already ratified so many. And then they indicate as to their status in terms of submission of reports to the United Nations. And how many more do we still want to ratify, taking into consideration the concern I've actually expressed to the people of our community around this.
Thank you very much, Chair, but we, as I've indicated, we do have progress. We have prepared for that, even though we did not put it in detail there. But let me just quickly, maybe we have given me a question. Let me just, you will just see the color light will give you a sense of where we are. So I thought the first one, we prepared a report, we've revised and everything else, and it's going through the cabinet process even as we speak.
So just putting in one on racial discrimination, it's being edited by Arts and Culture.
Yes, Chair.
Arts and Culture?
Yes, Chair.
Racial discrimination?
Yes, Chair. In terms of the cabinet, there is a cabinet decision to the effect that all international documents for standardization of language, not the substance, but the standardization of language and all of those things that other culture people are qualified to do, the packaging and all of that is done by them.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. No, we are consulting on informal consultation here because we have to go to cabinet for public consultation on the
too many things to remember on the catch report. But overall, we had done all the drafting aspects have already been done, and it's just a matter of now getting the document into the cabinet process. And in fact, I think when we prepared this, that was the situation, and I think the document is already in the cabinet process as we speak. This one has already gone through, and I think it's before this Honourable House now, I think. No, because we are still in progress with it. But we are almost ready to approach cabinet as well for it to come to the House. But we can meet the deadline with the attempt. The National Action Plan, oh no, the African Charter document, it's hard to talk about this one. Because I have to talk about it in context of the of what is obtaining in the media. There's a lot of write-ups about the ICC and all of that. But I think whatever outcome there will impact on how quickly we move with the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. So I'm not able to speak about it right now, but it's one of those things that we are watching. We had submitted a memo around November last year, but it was dealt with in March this year, on the African, making certain recommendations to cabinet on the African Charter and the adoption, as well as the, making South African to be able to access the African court, and that report came back from cabinet with one or two recommendations, with one or two suggestions that cabinet requested. We have since addressed that, and we will then be going back to cabinet to submit that. After that, we should be up and away. Then the National Action Plan.
Let me just ask you a question that probably is irrelevant, but out of curiosity, whether the African Court of Human and People's Rights is it not question?
It is and it isn't. in theory, it should be.
It exists, but does not exist.
Well, okay. No, all I'm saying, and I don't want things to come out badly, it's there, but for it to be functional, each member state must give its national the, call it the power, I don't know what's the right way, but call it the power to be able to go and access and use the court. So the court is there for all intents and purposes. I think we sent that is there as well. I think the JP, not helping, just JP, I think is a member of the court. So indeed, it is there, but it just needs people, countries, people, citizens of various countries to go and approach it for relief, whatever relief is needed. And that's the work that we took to cabinet and made certain recommendations around. Thank you. And so I'm sorry, that's a different area of work. So let me know I'm trying to send it. Yeah, so then the last one is the National Action Plan. Is that the last one? Yeah. And the document is done and we are going public. I think we are going for national, for public consultation. If not by the end of this month, at least by November, we will be conducting on the national action plan. But it's all done. We've done the internal consultation. We've conducted the NGOs. Now we are putting it to the public space for the South Africans to look at it and to come back to us and say yay or nay.
Thank you, Ben. Terry,
with your permission, may I ask a question? I would like to ask you, say, 4 points rather than it. Now, the question is on the strategic goals, in particular, number 4. That is, all children in South Africa are safe, and it's safe. Now, how will this noble idea address the so-called dark figure of crime, which refers to those crimes, not reported to the police, but very serious? This dark figure of crime seriously affects the South African society. However, this is, I think, a bonus. Don't answer this question. I'm just giving you a clue.
The professor is broken. I just need to be assisted by the chair. If the professor can ask the question so that I see that I understand it. Dark figure of crime.
The dark figure of crime is a concept we use in criminology, the side of crime, and criminology, the side of punishment. We call it the dark figure of crime because these crimes don't come to the police, they don't come to the courts, so they're not there. But the impact they have on society is more than the impact crimes have to spoken. That is what the professor means.
I didn't want to answer
your
question thinking I understand, you know, I didn't. There are three initiatives, and I'm not answering the question, but I'm just sharing the information. There are three initiatives that arise out of the, we have a policy framework, I'm trying to remember the name, I can't remember the name right now, but we have the policy framework that speaks in general to focusing on rebuilding communities, revitalizing schools, doing away with drugs, protection of the vulnerable. It's basically an all-encompassing policy space that enables us to target those areas. And one, to educate both at school levels and the societal level about the need to report crimes on the one level, and on the other, the making our system conducive for people to come and report crimes. Now, let me give an example. In some communities, if someone commits a huge crime, like I can't think of a huge crime, sometimes the communities agree between themselves about the restorative processes and sort the problem out. So in the first 10 years, let's say someone kills an ant, in the first 10 years, this thing looks like it's solved. And then 20 years later, it comes back as a grudge fight and people still fight over it. So we try and encourage people that if something like that has happened, you still have to ensure that the rehabilitation process continues to happen and people are assisted in other ways other than bringing them through a criminal justice system. If people have already resolved, maybe murder is the wrong way, is the wrong example, but when people wrong each other. So it's that which talks to community engagement. And I think there was a project which will probably start in MS in the new financial year that was identified, which will be driven by social development, that talks to communities, the family network, how do we rebuild families. Because we believe that someone who kills someone, who rapes someone, comes from somebody and family. And if this family has turned their backs on those people, perhaps, but secondly, sometimes they cover up for those people. So it's those things that you can measure and put in targets, but that is work that we are engaged in. For instance, if I may use an unrelated example, the continued disturbances that are currently being experienced by the Magana community, you had to do a lot more work than the work that would be justice related, like going there, talking to people, going there, launching community collecting forums in those areas, engaging and ensuring that people get together and they talk and they make peace between themselves so that they can continue as a society and not keep taking hits at each other. Whether it will work today or you start seeing the impact in the next 5 years, but the intervention must still happen and must be sustained. And we hope to see the outcomes of it in the many years to come, not now. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, through your DG,
relay down to the public. I think it's important because, see, in the minds of a lot of people, the Commission's budget is just about its budget and people, things are going to come to mind about now, just to relay people's fears, somehow, like, then this, the absence of the DG, so that's going to just ratify her and think about it. Anything else on the room? None. Right. Let's break for lunch. Can we come in at 2? 2. Alright, thank you.
One thirty-four for the Human Rights Commission, 134 to the Department to decide how to split between Maricon and ASEAN.